This is Atsuko from Shonen Life, and you are listening to WMFO in Medford, 91.5 FM.
One day I'll go and leave this place behind, below the moon, a different state of mind, assume myself.
Get up! Good afternoon. There we go. WMFO, Chuck Morse, right here at Tufts University, 91.5 AM, Medford, Boston. Welcome to the program. I do it every Thursday, 10 a.m. Eastern Standard Time, as I hold Ford as the lone conservative in one of America's most liberal college campuses, that being the very heart of the very soul of liberalism, as I bring alternative and voices with a hope, with a goal and the hope of fostering thought and opinion and conversation between people of reasonable differences. You're welcome, of course, to join the program, 855-915-9636, 855-915-9636. Well, now I have a full house here of live guests, which is kind of unusual. I haven't really done this before, and everyone who listens knows I'm kind of ham-handed when it comes to technical stuff. So if things start to go south, don't worry about it. We are joined live in the studio by the Reverend Stephen L. Kraft. He's with Project 21. Reverend Kraft, thanks for joining me today.
Thanks for having me, Chuck.
All right. And also right over here to my left, at least figuratively, not literally, because these guys make me look like a left-winger, that being Hal Shurtleff from Camp Constitution. Hal, thanks for joining me.
Always a pleasure. I remember my first time I met you 20 years ago in the same studio.
That's right. That's right. And things were very different then. We could talk about that. And, of course, Dr. Kishore is an expert on opiate addiction and had been the CEO of several clinics across the state that were literally and statistically reducing opiate addiction until they were shut down by the state. Dr. Kishore, thanks for joining me.
Thanks a lot, Chuck, having me on the show here.
It's my pleasure. Okay, so I want to first start out with you, Reverend Kraft, to talk a little bit about kind of what's happening with race relations, especially now that President Donald Trump is in office. It seems to me that President Trump has a natural constituency within the minority community in this country because he is supporting law and order. He is supporting work. He's supporting jobs. He's supporting economy that can actually help people self-actualize and become self-sufficient. He's supporting faith. And we know that the left has engaged in an assault on the black church, which has been one of the great moral arbiters of this country. I think it's restored Christianity as a whole. And he's attacked the and he supports family, which has been under attack by the left after half a century of welfare and other programs that have particularly targeted minorities. What then goes forward with regard to reaching young black people and telling them that they have here a revolutionary opportunity to lift themselves up and to take on, you know, their own lives and their own destinies?
I appreciate you asking me that question, Brother Chuck. One of the main issues and one of the main problems in a lot of black culture at this time is the fact that because of the legacy of slavery, even though the chains have been taken physically off the body of black Americans, now the chains over a period of time through leftist and Marxist ideology has been put on their minds. And I'm reading out of a book produced by a gentleman back in the late 50s by the name of Manning Johnson, who was a black communist at high levels, and he was trained in the Kremlin. But he had a Christian foundation. He had a Christian background. And as he advanced in the communist ranks, he discovered that communism, Marxism, was not going to be the so-called utopia in the propaganda that he was fed. And he wrote this book entitled Color, Communism, and Common Sense. And we here at Camp Constitution, we have reprinted the book. But in his chapter on the failure of the black church, he writes, he says, one who is familiar with red trickery, it's obvious that placing the blame for all of the Negro's ills at the door of the white leaders in America is to thereby remove all responsibility from the Negro. This makes the Negro, one, feel sorry for himself, two, blame others for his failures,
3, ignore the countless opportunities around him. 4, be jealous of the progress of other racial and national groups. And 5, expect the white man to do everything for him. And finally, look for easy and quick solutions as a substitute for the harsh realities of competitive struggle to get ahead. And the result of this is a persecution and a victim complex. This warped belief that the white man's prejudices, the white man's system, the white man's government is responsible for everything. And such a belief, such as this, is the way that the communists have planned this, because the next logical step is hatred. When Donald Trump got elected, the best kept secret now in the United States is that Donald Trump had a substantial black support in the black community. But we're not hearing that. I voted for Donald Trump. I am an older black American. I'm 73 years old. Donald Trump never had any problems with anyone as long as he was building casinos, as long as he was building high-rises in New York City. I live in New Jersey. I'm only a hop, step, and jump away from New York City. But no one ever had any problems with the Donald. But as soon as God elevated him to the highest position in the land, now all of a sudden he's worse than the devil himself. So what people have got to understand is simply this, and especially in the black culture, we have to understand, like you said, that one of our greatest opportunities during this time is for black people to get beyond their mental chains, their mental slavery, and realize that no, our problems are not Donald Trump. Our problems are not Caucasian culture. Our problems are between our two ears. And as we understand and recognize this and recognize that God has placed Donald Trump in that position. He didn't get there on his own. God put him there. And because of that, he is fulfilling that passage of scripture. Being a minister of the gospel, I relate this way. He's fulfilling that passage of scripture where God said that they, that God puts in office, will rebuild the old ruined places, namely the ghettos, and rebuild those generations who have been devastated over generations of time.
I think that that's quite eloquently stated, and I think that, President Trump is in that sense a revolutionary figure, which is why the entire establishment, not just the Democrats and the liberals, but the establishment Republicans, international establishment, the top 1% wealthy, that they're just doing everything they can to stop him, to destroy him. It's an amazing thing to see this man come along, and he just keeps going and he stands up to it. And we can really, I generally have not been a person who prays every day, but I do pray every day for him.
Yes.
I just find that to be the case. It's almost like it just happens. Hal?
Well, Chuck, can you hear me through the speakers?
Yeah.
Okay. Because I'm
good.
Not hearing. Okay, great. Yeah. That book he read from was actually published in 1958. So it's not something that, of course, the term Negro was accepted generic term, a neutral term. But the same, when Reverend Kraft found that book in my library many years ago, recently, assumed he must have read this because we're in the same circle, a lot of travel in the same circles. And he, when he read it, he said it could have been written yesterday.
Oh, absolutely. I got the, Hal, you sent me the book recently, and I got that sense. These are the same issues that we've been dealing with really since time immemorial.
Yes.
I mean, it's and in a sense, I would suggest that the black community has been able to thrive in spite of the left in many cases, as people are becoming more successful. They are becoming middle and upper class. They have held on to their faith. They have held on to their family in spite of a leftist agenda. And yet, you know, there continues to be great tragedy. And in a sense, now that, you know, racism in the formal sense of like Jim Crow laws and legal discrimination, now that that's gone, and now that there's a waning of that, and I don't think anyone denies that racism exists, it does, but it's no longer the political issue that it actually prevents somebody from getting ahead. I mean, I think, for example, as a Jew, that anti-Semitism exists, but it doesn't stop me in my life. I mean, there are certainly anti-Semitic agendas out there, like boycotting Israel and giving Iran nuclear bombs, all done by Obama. Mm-hmm. But it's not like something that stops me from conducting my affairs, which is why they are now inventing a micro-racism. So now they have to take out a microscope and they look for racist cells, you know, like so-and-so, you know, might have had like the wrong look at someone.
They,
or they
call
might
it
have
microaggressions.
Had, yeah, maybe they moved the wrong way, or they kind of had this and this kind of tyranny, this kind of totalitarianism, we should note, is only directed at people who don't genuflect to the left. This isn't applied to left wingers. I mean, it's just, you know, this is utter, nothing more than a new form of totalitarianism. And if there's one thing that Donald Trump has accomplished, it's that he stood up to that and he goes, no, I'm not going to be part of that. I'm going to speak my mind. I've obviously, people look at him. Does he have something against black men and women? Of course not. They know that, which is why they have to pull out the microscope. And, let's see. In 19, it reminds me of the, you know, I mean, it's like, oh, he was seen with somebody, you know, who once had a relative who once said this, you know, and this kind of stuff, you know, is really.
But you know, Chuck, that kind of subtle racism is more insidious and more dangerous than the overt racism of the 50s and the 60s, where it was in your face. You could deal with that,
right?
Because you knew where people were coming from. But this insidious micro, as they call it, racism, this spirit of what they call microaggressions.
Right, and when we talk about insidious, we're talking about the people who are a part of the microaggression movement. Which, by the way, was started by a Harvard professor back in the 70s. His name escapes me right now. He happened to be black, who was one of these who said that, I mean, he had a bunch of outrageous things that he was into. But anyways.
Yeah, last week at Fenway Park, home of the Boston Red Sox, some drunken fan yelled a racial epithet to the player, the Baltimore Orioles player in center field.
Right.
And he was thrown out and banned for life.
Sure.
And it was, I mean, all the headlines.
Right.
You read the headlines and you think, my goodness, there's a Klan rally at Fenway Park in the bleachers every game.
Right.
But really, what was one drunken, probably a liberal Democrat, if you do the demographics, probably a liberal Democrat, got drunk, and they threw him out and they banned him for life. And the next day, the player's at bat and he gets a standing ovation. I mean, why is it still an issue? But the Bay State banner,
the governor weighed in.
Story.
Yeah. The mayor weighed in. Everybody starts coming out, waving.
The next day, there's a black man, I believe he may have been an illegal, undocumented worker. I got to be careful. Right? Two people, he murdered two people. Nobody in the white community said it's a race crime, a hate crime. You know,
well,
so
this,
I mean,
is what, look, you have to realize that the left thinks in terms of, this paradigm of oppression and oppressed.
Yeah.
And they've decided, I mean, I'll give you another example recently, right here at Tufts University on the eve of Passover, when the Jewish students were away, the school senate secretly, which is unprecedented for them because they had a secret meeting, where they decided to vote to boycott Israel, mm-hmm. right? Three companies that do business with Israel. This is on the same day that, well, I don't want to describe the nature of the people who did this because we can't, I'll get kicked off the air, but let's just say a group of people slaughtered an entire church, a Christian church in Egypt. Right, went in and murdered everyone in there. And it was also 2 days before another person, we won't mention the nature of that philosophy, drove a truck into a crowd in London and stabbed a policeman continuously until he was killed. They didn't have anything to say about that. You know, it's like, it's a really bizarre construct, actually.
Yes.
But I think that perhaps a way to get around that is to think of it as the old Marxist dialectic of, you know, the conspiracy of exploitation that Marx developed, that there's a secret conspiracy on the part of the bourgeoisie to exploit people, which is to say anybody who works for a living is exploited. Mm-hmm. And that
zero-sum game.
Yeah, and that basically Marx viewed such institutions as faith in God and family and property and trade in goods and services, that these were, quote, false consciousness. They were invented mm-hmm. as part of this conspiracy by people who wanted to exploit everyone else. So when you look at life through that paradigm, then you have to see the state of Israel as the exploiter. Why? Because Israel is a successful economy. It's capitalist because it believes in God. It's Jewish. And because they view it as predominantly white, even though it's not. It's actually one of the most diverse ethnically and racially in societies in the world. And that you know, it stands up for itself as a sovereign state, you know, and it doesn't make any bones about that. It doesn't apologize for that. It'll stand up for the rights of its own citizens and their property and do whatever is necessary to make sure that that's protected. So those are enemies of the left. Therefore, they're exploiting. Never mind the, you know, other states around them that are you know, actually quite oppressive to their people. That's ignored. It's like that doesn't exist. It's simply airbrushed out of the picture. And, you know, they criticized criticized Donald Trump for meeting with, I was listening to left-wing radio. Oh, he met with somebody from a foreign country. He was inviting the president of the Philippines.
Oh, yes.
Oh, I mean, but never mind the fact that Obama went to visit the bloody dictator of Cuba, mm-hmm. which had put 15,000 people in front of a firing squad.
And many people of color in front of a firing squad.
That's right. Not to mention gays. Never mind. We won't go there. But the thing is that's airbrushed out of the picture. So you have to realize you're dealing with a very topsy-turvy. It's actually, you know, there's a psychological term called projection. Mm-hmm. When you take that which is who you are and you project it onto your perceived enemies. And so when the Marxists talk about, you know, creating false consciousness, that's exactly what they're doing.
And see, the spiritual foundation, Chuck, for that is found in Isaiah chapter 5, where it says that the wicked will be called righteous, the righteous will be called wicked, light will be called darkness, darkness will be called light, good will be called evil, evil will be called good, sweet will be called bitter, and bitter will be called sweet. Everything is turned upside down, and as you said, topsy-turvy on its head today.
And of course, at the very core of that is, and this is maybe too broad an issue to get into, but what you have there is Satanism.
That's right.
This is where the dark angel resides. Everything is turned on its head.
Right.
I mean, if you take a look at the Satanic Mass, they take the Catholic Mass and they reverse everything.
Mm-hmm.
Everything goes backwards. Everything is upside down. The idea of overthrowing the social order that was established by God in the Torah. You know, this idea, and that this is something that is necessary in order to create a world run by man. I mean, Whitaker Chambers talks about this in his introduction to The Witness, that we have a choice between God or man.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, Dr. Kishore.
Yes, on that score, you know, we have a great deal said about pharmakia in the Bible, how pharmacological hallucinatory drugs are to be abhorred and to have a sane society. And now we are promoting that like there's no tomorrow. We have drugs that are flowing into the country. We are being promoted by the top officials in the country. Well, of course, it was not before Trump's time.
Right.
And it's kind of a jaw-dropping situation where we are saying it's okay to do drugs. It's okay to, they call it harm reduction. They use euphemisms so that people think, oh my God, it's okay to use a little bit of drugs. And the sobriety is given a short shift. There's no element of staying sane and safe.
Mm-hmm.
And if you go to any of the detox centers in Greater Boston, they all have a big sign on the door saying your family is your disease. They want mm-hmm. The addict to be dealing from the family systems and be in an addict colonies, so that the family system is essentially being shredded to pieces in the detox centers. So they project the mom and dad as the people who cause the disease of addiction in the child. You know, we're seeing this perverse approach to the addiction treatment. It's a man-made epidemic. It's not
Well, they're trying to claim that somehow it's, as you say, it's, quote, a disease, that it's right. It's genetic. That doesn't mean that there might not be some genetic dispositions among some people, but nevertheless, it's a choice.
Right,
that by taking away the moral condemnation of it, or at least the teaching that it's bad, that sobriety is good, that this is, you know, that's too judgmental. They're opening it up. Plus, you got George Soros pouring in millions of dollars since the 1980s in legalizing marijuana, which is a gateway drug, and, you know, kind of decriminalizing and making this, like, morally neutral as a way to, I don't know what the bigger agenda is there. I mean, hell, I mean, are they trying to get everybody hooked on something, or what's going on?
Well, if you the idea is to destabilize the culture,
right,
the family,
right.
And if you spend all your time dealing with that addict in your family, you don't have time to do much more. Between the, you know, mother and father are working. If there is a mother and father in the house, they're both working. The younger children are daycare, and their brother is, their older child is hooked on drugs. And that's it consumes the family.
I see. So that it's a... Plus, Dr. Kishore, you've talked about how the state actually makes money from drug addicts.
All right. I think it's essentially commoditizing the human populations. You know, right after this, we'll be heading up to the methadone mile, the so-called methadone mile,
mm-hmm.
where they have set up these in the industrial zone near Boston Medical Center. They set up like 4 methadone clinics, umpteen suboxone clinics, and pain clinics. So that's the that's the apex of this infection, source of infection for the state, stems from that 1 mile of methadone clinics. And
that's over in South End, right?
That's in South End.
Mass Avenue.
Yeah, Boston Medical Center.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
If you see there, I think it's a gruesome scene, out of this world. People frozen in time right on the pavement with their hands up.
I've seen it, yeah.
Mm-hmm. I want to point out, too, for your listeners, a documentary is in post-production about not just Dr. Kishore's ordeal, but the bigger picture. It's called Heroin America. And there's a website. They have they've released some of the video, some of the clips they're doing,
mm-hmm.
and your listeners should check it out. And it's, you know, this isn't, should not be a left right issue.
No, of course not.
I mean, you want,
should not be, even though it is.
Yeah.
But yeah, absolutely.
Hero or Heroin America, and all three of us, so Reverend Kraft's in it, and I got a little part in it as well.
Great. Yeah. I mean, go ahead.
And see, the thing you just mentioned it, Chuck, and all three of us spoke on this issue on our way up here. Drug addiction at its root brings forth diseases, but the truth of the matter is drug addiction in and of itself is not a disease. It's
right.
A moral issue.
But it creates, it's once, right. Once you're in it, yeah, get sick.
Right, because no one can become an alcoholic or a drug addict without making a moral decision to use.
And by the way, Reverend Kraft was a heroin addict many years ago, from experience.
Yeah, and it's common sense. I cannot get hooked on alcohol or drugs without making a conscious choice to use these substances.
That's
no
right.
One ties anybody down and then mainlines heroin into their veins. That's the reason why the stigma on one hand of drug addiction never dissipates. But then on the other hand, looking at it from the opposite perspective, we see this push now for recreational marijuana use. The key term there is recreational. What do they mean by that? You know,
like it's fun?
Right.
Right. This is
there's
like,
you
know,
the word
there.
Recreation means to recreate.
Right.
As opposed to amusement. Amusement is with no knowledge, right? Without knowledge or without learning.
Right.
But recreate is something constructive, like you're hiking or you're bicycling or something.
Interesting.
Or amusement is you're just going out.
Recreating addicts because once a person is in
that's a good way to look at
drugs,
it. Yeah.
You can't function. You can't think. You can't make rational decisions. That's why marijuana is a gateway drug. I smoked reefer back in the 60s for years. That then led to snorting heroin and cocaine, which led to skin popping heroin and cocaine, which led to mainlining heroin and cocaine. And the same way I made a choice to get on narcotics, I had to suffer for 5 years in order to get clean and sober. Been clean and sober now since 1976.
You know, I have some libertarian leanings, free market type approaches, and a lot of the libertarians support the legalization of marijuana.
Thank you.
I looked at it as the drug cartel is making money on both ends. They're making money by selling the stuff. They're making money by treating the people that get hooked.
And they're probably making money with people in prison, too.
Exactly.
But,
exactly.
You know, it gets into a left issue in that when someone is hooked on a controlled substance, a highly refined substance that goes right into your system, that's a person that is no longer, that's impaired when it comes to making moral decisions. That is someone who is more susceptible to collective decisions.
Right.
It's part of this general sociological trend of breaking down not just the individual person who is a drug addict, but the family and other institutions that stand in the way of collectivism.
Correct.
You know, this is a way to dumb down, you know, the late great Dr. Samuel L. Blumenfeld, who I wish he could be here to talk about. You know, he talked about how the education system is used like this. By the way, I've got some great interviews with Sam.
We
want to
archive them on our Camp Constitution archived, because as you know, I got most of his library was
I'm not trying to toot my own horn here. Nothing to do with me, but the radio show that I did with Sam, the many of them are just some of the best radio ever. It's just amazing.
All the links I want, because we'll get them up on and we are actually getting about 180,000 views a month.
Yeah.
And we got 20,000 downloads of his books in the last 4 weeks.
Excellent. Because I think that people will love this stuff. It's just, Sam is, you know, he's funny. He's on a roll. He just has incredible insights. I think about Sam every day. I read the news. I'm like, what would Sam say about this?
That's, you know, right.
It's like, it's amazing.
Well, it's interesting that Sam resonated well with Reverend Kraft, because Sam wrote about the eugenics and the creation of the black underclass.
That's right.
And then he also resonated with Dr. Kishore, because in the inner city, if you can't read and you can't get a decent job, you're more inclined to begin in the drug side of things, to sell drugs, to buy drugs, to get involved in the drug problem.
Yeah.
So it sort of runs hand in hand between the race issue and the addiction issue.
Plus, you get the dumbing down in education. You get the anti-business attitude.
That's right.
Which keeps people from getting into jobs and getting started in business. All of it. I mean, it's all sort of an informal, it's like what it's what Whitaker Chambers called the conspiracy of gentlemen. Right? Not necessarily people sitting around in a smoke-filled room, but they think alike.
Yes.
I think it was Carl Bernstein, his, you know, the liberal.
The reporter, Washington Post.
Yeah, Washington Post. His father was a communist. I don't know if you've seen his book, his biography, but he actually has some insights there. One of the things his father said, which was interesting, was don't report about Senator Joe McCarthy because he was right. But putting putting that one aside, he also said he once asked his father, how is it that the communists operate? Do you, like, get orders from the Kremlin? And he goes, no, we don't need to get orders from the Kremlin. We all think alike.
And you they're trained to think.
Yeah.
And they this is what we do.
It's like a little computer chip into the back of their skulls. It's all the impulses go out. I've seen this. I've seen this in members of my own family.
I think it was Elizabeth Bentley who wrote, who was a former communist.
Right.
And I think she said that when we couldn't reach a decision, we went to the Waldorf Astoria Hotel and there was
some money bags.
That was the actual, okay, this a direct line to what the Kremlin. If we don't know what to do, then we ask this person. And she did, and she never revealed him, I don't think. But you would be surprised. Some pretty well-known person, even somebody may be known in Republican or conservative circles.
Oh, yeah, for sure. I can think of a certain senator, but we won't go there. It was a Republican. Yeah.
From New York, right?
That's right.
Yeah, I know.
You know who I mean. One of the other things that President Trump has become under criticism for, besides being politically incorrect and not caring and thus liberating the rest of us from this tyranny and this fear that everything we say is going to destroy our lives and our reputations if we don't goose step to the left, is his war on drug dealers. Absolutely. And his war on crime. This is one of the reasons, and he's said it many times, why he wants to build the wall. Now, I know he's backed away from that, but we have to urge him to build the wall. That wall has to be built in full, all the way from, you know, the Gulf of Mexico to the Pacific. There has to be a wall. Because if they don't build the wall, then the next administration could come in and change policies. I mean, I applaud the fact that he's reduced illegal immigration, and that's great. And, yeah, he's increased surveillance. And he's basically enforcing laws that Obama refused to enforce. But they have to build the wall. But putting that aside, the fact is that he is tough. One of the reasons why he said he's going to do it is to stop international big money drug dealers from pouring drugs into this country. That's what I think is the trouble for the establishment. Mm-hmm. That, and also Attorney General Jeff Sessions telling federal prosecutors that they're going to go after the serious criminals and get them on three strikes. And we're talking here about people who are real big drug dealers. He's not putting some poor, you know, schlub in jail who has a nickel bag. I mean, they're talking about people who are who are terrorizing neighborhoods and who are disseminating these dangerous poisons. Mm-hmm. And that's why I think he's been under fire. One of the other things that's shocking the establishment.
Well, it's interesting about the theologian Rush Dooney said that the only way the mafia can exist is with the complacency of the government.
Right.
And that goes with the drugs. It goes with, and it goes with the, I refer to what Dr. Kishore was taken down by the medical mafia.
That's right.
Which something he wasn't aware about until it was too late. And right. There's an educational mafia. There's an environmental mafia. And these guys don't go around with machine guns. They go around with agents, with bad law. You
know? There's the IRS mafia.
The IRS mafia.
Right? I mean, the Lois Lerner scandal, right? They created these laws in 1913 that you could get a nonprofit tax deductible. You could set up a foundation, really, for the left.
That's right.
And yet, suddenly, some conservatives woke up and said, "Gee, I want to do this." And all of a sudden, no, these aren't for you.
That's right.
You know, that doesn't. You don't get that.
It was interesting too when they go after smaller foundations, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation.
Right.
They took over public government education in this country by creating Common Core, and with the influence they had, they got the Obama administration. I'm sure there would be, if Bush was president, or
right,
they got them to introduce. They spent billions of dollars. He's going to be making money hand over fist, by the way. He's not doing it for altruistic
right,
purposes.
Right, I'm sure.
And that not one peep out of the mainstream press. And as our friend Dr. Pester said, if this was the Koch brothers, and I'm not a fan of the Koch brothers.
Right, I get that.
If the Koch brothers spent $10 billion to take over education, they'd be screaming from the rooftops.
Sure.
But they were applauded because this billionaire Gates, they agree with his philosophy.
That's right.
Totalitarian agenda.
And the Koch brothers, and I'm not a big fan either, but they tend to be, they're not on the left, and they tend to have a lot of libertarian stands. They're the only two people in the top 10, if you look at the Forbes 100 richest Americans,
yeah,
who are not on the left.
That's right.
And that's why they're being attacked.
That's right, exactly.
I mean, the top 1%, as Elizabeth Warren calls them, the millionaires and the billionaires, all left of center.
Left. That's right.
All support left causes. You take a look at the top 100, probably about 80% of them are leftists.
All the big corporations.
Oh, you're all headed up by leftists.
Completely have embraced the leftist agenda.
Chuck, yes. You know, small message for the young people. You know, we're seeing the youth getting decimated by the addiction epidemic right now. You know, they got to take it to heart that the future is at stake. You know, normally the societies are like a pyramid, you know, strong, a lot of babies in the bottom of the pyramid, a lot of older people living to senescence, and the strong mid oak in the middle, the young fellas, 18 to 49, who are holding up the care of the children and the adults. Right now, we are seeing the thinning of the middle. Young people are dying faster than the older people. The babies are still being born. So now we are seeing an epidemic of child abuse, abandonment, mistreatment of the elderly. So I think it's time the youth wake up. You know, you're in the heart of young people here in Tufts University. If anybody's listening, they got to take up the challenge of taking care of their own generation.
But what Dr. Kishore said, the whole agenda of the Marxist ideology is to break down the spirit of individualism and the spirit of family, and to bring forth a spirit of collectivism, which they then control. And see, from looking at this thing as a minister of the gospel, from a spiritual perspective, the Bible tells us why all the nations are flowing toward the left. Because the Bible says that the God, small g, of this world is Satan the devil. And Satan the devil, being the god of this world, is always going to move people in a direction that is anti-God, anti-Christ, anti-Judeo-Christian ethic. So that's the reason why you don't see people moving toward the right. They're all moving toward the left. So one must ask oneself, why is this? What's causing this phenomenon for all the nations of the world moving leftward rather than rightward, or even a balance of the two? There's a spiritual reason that that's happening. And the spiritual reason is that the God of this world, who is a spiritual being, we can't visibly see Satan, but Satan exists, just like God exists. And because of that, if we don't understand the spiritual dynamics that's fueling this mess, we're never going to be able to grasp it. That's why John the Baptist says that the spiritual acts
which is the word of God, and the Torah must be laid to the root of this wicked tree, which is this Marxist, leftist, collectivist, wicked, anti-Christ, anti-Judeo ethic, has to root that thing up. And what God has done with Donald Trump is, because Donald Trump is a builder, and also Donald Trump is like the proverbial bull in the china shop, God has put him in that high position to do what? To root up, throw down, tear down, then plant and build. See, he's a builder. He knows how to plant, he knows how to build, but he also knows how to root up, tear down, and throw down. And that's what we need in America now. We need a revival of upheaval. We need people who love this nation. We need people who love this country, who love God, who love our Judeo-Christian foundation, to come together, because the left's in one accord. I don't care if you're talking about...
Oh, yeah, they all think alike.
They all think alike. Yeah. I don't care what single issue...
Oh, no, they'll all march in lockstep.
The right is just the opposite.
What's interesting, though, is we've seen some backlash around in Western Europe. It may not be motivated by purely spiritual reasons, but people in England, they got Brexit. France, although they did elect the moderate,
right? Nevertheless, still right of center.
But it seems to be there's a movement now against internationalism,
right?
And I remember the left coming out against these Trans-Pacific partnerships, and I remember they had these riots in what was it, Washington State?
In Seattle.
Yeah, Seattle. Well, then they should be delighted that Donald Trump said no TPP.
Yeah, but their position against it is
different
for entirely different
because
reasons.
Because it doesn't go far enough.
Right. They want to have, you know, environmental rules. They want to have socialist...
Which are on there already, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, they want more of that. Yeah. They want more world government.
Yeah.
You know, it's like the, in a sense, the support for... you know, the dismantling of the NAFTA agreement, and which is something that President Trump has stood strong for. His motivation for that and his motivation for controlling illegal immigration is because he wants to, he wants to preserve, among other things, to preserve American industry and labor, but also preserve American culture. The left's thing is very different. They want to, they're interested in illegal. Well, I think let me put it this way. I mean, the opposition to I kind of am losing my train of thought here.
Well, when Trump's inaugural address, we discussed this when we went on air.
Right.
He said that we want to have good relations with all the countries of the world, but we put the interest of our country first. And then he said, and I expect the other countries of the world to put the interest of their nations first. And when I watched Rachel Maddow comment, they're all like, wow, can you believe what he said? Like it was the worst possible thing to actually care about our country first.
Well, that's the main, my thing is that the right supports a certain amount of illegal immigration because they want to have cheap labor. Or they want to see
more
industry.
Of the establishment.
The establishment. Or they want to see, a lowering of the cost of labor. The left is because they want world government. They want to destroy American culture.
And the concept of borders.
But they both kind of come together in agreement on it. But you got, Hal, right to the crux of the issue. With all the other things we've talked about with Donald Trump, the tough on crime and getting rid of the drug dealers, the building of the wall, the support for faith and family, it all comes down to this very statement you just made of putting America first. Now, that seems like just a slogan to some people, and it even seems like a radical idea to some people because they're used to successive administrations going all the way back to Franklin Roosevelt, who used all this sort of totalitarian language of vagary. I mean, French scholar Elaine Benescon called it the language of totalitarianism.
Mm-hmm.
Where you use indirection, it's almost its own code word. It's the sophistries. Nothing is directly said, but it's all moving toward this idea of a world order.
Well, the American First movement that came from Charles Lindbergh and others, it was initially to prevent us from getting into the war.
Right.
And it was made up of mainly good American people There was a handful of Nazis.
Sure.
American. There was also communists.
That's right. They were leftists.
When the Nazis and the Russians signed that non-aggression pact, they were allies, and the communists in the United States were told to support the Nazis.
That's right.
And up until the invasion, that when Hitler launched the invasion against Russia, then all of a sudden, just like that.
Like a split.
Let's have a second front now. And they got out.
Right.
But when the war was declared, all the American First people, the leaders, all of them offered their services, you know, to the president.
Exactly.
And Charles Lindbergh was treated very badly by Roosevelt.
That's right.
And he still, even though he was unauthorized, he still got involved. In fact, he was lost in the Pacific for
that's right. Although he, weeks. I must say, he did embrace some Jewish conspiracy theories. But let's put that aside.
Yeah.
The fact is that the left, and we should point out, they were pro-Hitler in the first 2 years of World War II.
That's right.
There's no way around that.
That's right.
I mean, that's a fact of history. But now we have the present, where you have President Trump speaking about putting America first. That is a shocking, horrifying idea to the establishment. People aren't used to that. But let's just briefly look at that. Putting our nation first, you know, the way they phrase it, oh, this means we don't care about other nations. Nonsense. If I was in Zimbabwe, I'd want to put Zimbabwe first. If I was in Ceylon, I'd put Ceylon first. The idea is that you put your own nation first over other nations, so you can then deal with the rest of the world from a position of strength. And that it's the same principle. It's a principle in nature. You put yourself first. You put your own family first. Animals understand this. You know, you try to invade a bird's nest, you'll find out that the bird's putting its nest first.
And the birds the little sparrows will take on the hawk, too.
Yeah,
be successful.
Try to interrupt the space of a dog. You know, the animals, this is something that's natural, too. It's kind of hardwired into the human being. It's not even something it's just normal.
You know, there was a British statesman in the early, mid-1800s, Richard Cobden, and he said, peace will come to this world when its people have as much to do with each other, its governments the least.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the United States, we have missionaries all over the world. I have Chris Ann Hall, one of our camp instructors. She and her husband go to Haiti. They're not just going there they're going there with material needs and spiritual needs. Reverend Kraft's going to South Africa. You know, he's been there several times to help people in South Africa. We are a very generous people. We help people all over the world.
Of course.
Private sector. Doctors Without Frontiers. They do
That's
incredible
right.
work.
Amazing,
governments always
yeah.
get involved. Karl Malone, the basketball player, during the hurricane, you know, the flooding in New Orleans, he dispatched vehicles, and they were stopped by government agents.
Mm-hmm.
We want to help the problem. No, we'll take care of it. And because they made a mess of things. So it's not this idea of isolationism. And I think of John Quincy Adams when he said, we are for everywhere the friends of freedom, but the protectors only of our own, you know.
Amazing. Amazing quote. And so thus you have the war against Trump is a war against a movement. It's not just the man, it's the movement. And they may take him out, but it is a war right now.
Yes.
I have never seen anything more fierce. The minute he was elected, it was not supposed to happen. I think that if they thought that Trump actually would win, they would have brought the voter fraud out even more than they did.
Mm-hmm.
But they didn't pull out the whole machine this time like they did for Obama. That's my opinion. There's no proof.
Right.
Although President Trump, to his credit, has set up a commission now to look into this, which I think is amazing.
But I think it's important that we as constitutionalists still have to hold that administration to the right
of
standards.
Course.
And Trump is not a constitutionalist, but he's a far better... now, I know if Sam Blumenfeld was sitting next to us and you'd asked him, what do you think about the new Department of Education secretary?
Right.
Sam would have said her job would be to auction off all the assets and then pass the auction mallet and then resign and then abolish the cabinet.
Oh, I think that Sam actually had some dealings with Betsy DeVos.
Really, yeah.
She's amazing. I mean, she's trying to, you know, she's... a supporter of a gradual privatization.
Is she really? Yeah.
Oh, yeah. I mean, the charter school movement, the, you know, homeschool movement. I mean, no, she's amazing. I mean, we can't be purists.
No, that's true.
But, yeah. And that's one of the reasons why she's, booed at, you know, at high schools. And although I admire that the college president stood up and said, if I hear another boo, we're calling it off. You can collect your diplomas in the office. You know, that's it. But the war is reaching a fever pitch. I mean, it's been there every single day that he's been in office. Things that he is doing that are normal for any president are now criminalized. You know, having a meeting with a foreign secretary and trading various secrets, that's something that goes back to Washington meeting the British ambassador. That's what you do. That's perfectly normal. But for Trump to do it, that's criminal. So,
well, when he got really fired Comey, my goodness, all of the people, he can't do that. But just about 4 or 5 months ago, the left was saying Comey's the reason why Hillary lost. They want to.
But the thing is, he can do it. Look at Andrew Johnson. He may not have been a great president, but he was almost impeached for firing his Secretary of War Stanton.
That's right.
And he was not impeached, and it was virtually understood that he had a right to do that. This is what president. This is his cabinet.
That's right.
You know, these are These are executive
officials. No, they're appointed.
So I mean, but for Trump to do it, it becomes criminal. So anything Trump does is going to be the special prosecutor. I mean, I think as somebody said, you know, he had an extra scoop of ice cream. Let's bring in a special prosecutor. You know, it's like, I mean, it's crazy.
Think, though, the left, they're overplaying their hand. Yeah. And, you know, the term fake news, I get AOL. That means I'm an old guy, I guess. I didn't realize that until took a class and writing your cover, resume. Don't use AOL. Okay. But every day it's some I don't even pay attention to it because I know it's nonsense. It's not.
Well, I mean, this whole Russian thing is garbage, and it's worse than that. It's I don't know if you're following the business of Seth Rich, who was murdered in Washington.
Oh yes, I just saw something on that recently.
Now it's still unproven. Yeah. However, there's more evidence for that than there is for this Russia narrative, which I think is just an attempt by the left to keep Trump off center and to keep people not focused on what he is doing, and he's doing a lot.
Be on the defensive.
Seth Rich was a Democratic National Committee member who was an expert on computers, and he was working with he had like access to emails, and he was a Bernie Sanders guy, and he was upset about how the DNC, working as a stooge for Hillary Clinton, was basically doing Bernie Sanders in. So he released, according to a private investigator, 49,000 emails to WikiLeaks. And Julian Assange says this as well. Now, he did it through this filmmaker who then gave it to Julian Assange. It was 7 days after that he was murdered, and it was, they called it a robbery, but he was shot in the back. They didn't take anything. And that the filmmaker was murdered around the same time.
Fascinating.
And Julian Assange has offered an award for finding the murderers. This private investigator, hired by the family of Seth Rich or by somebody representing the family, says that there is the laptop that shows that he had given 49,000 emails to WikiLeaks. Now, that's the accusation made against the Russians. It was probably this guy, Seth Rich, among other people, who did it from the inside of the Democratic Party, right? I mean, I would think, I mean, or at least that's a possibility. So I'm hoping that with the special prosecutor now, which I think is a terrible development, but there it is, Robert Mueller, that he looks into this and that we should contact him and say, follow up on the Seth Rich thing. Let's find that computer. Because if they get that computer and they show that that's the source of the WikiLeaks, that's going to blow this whole thing open.
Now, is this
not to mention who murdered him? That's another question.
Isn't Mueller one of these guys that was involved with the North American Union? Not the same Mueller?
I don't know. I mean, he was FBI director under Bush and Obama.
Okay.
Before that, he was a special prosecutor. I don't think he was involved in politics.
It must have,
Same. That's another Mueller.
Yeah,
that's the UN Mueller.
Yeah. Okay.
Robert Mueller.
Okay.
That's another guy.
Right.
Anyways, gentlemen, we're reaching toward the end of the show, so I'd like you each to talk a little bit about how people can reach you, how they can get more information about your work, websites, etc. Reverend Kraft?
Yes, thank you, Chuck. People can reach me through my website, which is ChristianCitizenshipMinistries.org. That's ChristianCitizenshipMinistries.org. And my email is S as in Stephen, L as in Lewis, C as in Kraft, R as in Robert, A as in Apple, F as in Frank, T as in Tom, 1@
Verizon, the phone company, V as in Victor, ERIZON.net. That's SLCraft1@Verizon.net. I am involved in working in Christian conservative political activism. I am also an evangelist, a minister of the gospel, and I will be honored to help in any way I can to save our great nation.
Thank you very much, Reverend Kraft. It's an honor. Dr. Kishore.
Yes, thank you, Chuck, for having us. And my contact information is through campconstitution.net. You can reach me through the Speakers Bureau there. The Facebook page for the National Library of Health and Healing is another way to reach me. National Library of Health and Healing. We are situated in Waldoboro, but we
Maine.
Waldoboro, Maine, but we do things all across the country. And my personal email address is P as in Peter, S as in Samuel, Kishore, K-I-S-H-O-R-E, @AOL.com.
Thank you very much. And Hal Shurtleff, Camp Constitution.
Camp Constitution, you can find us on Facebook. We have a great YouTube channel. I do recommend the Sam Blumenfeld Archive. You go to our website, see the drop-down. And our Speakers Bureau, these gentlemen and myself are available to speak to groups on campus and to groups, you know, any groups around the country. So,
and what's coming up with Camp Constitution?
Well, our summer camp is coming up July 2nd to the 9th in the Ringe, New Hampshire, the Tohonippi Christian Retreat Center. And we have these two gentlemen will be giving presentations and classes. We have Larry Pratt of Gun Owners of America.
Oh, good.
We have Professor Willie Soon, who you should have on your show, one of the top climate scientists in the world, climate realists in the world, out of Harvard Smithsonian Institute. And John McManus, our old friend John McManus, who I'm sure has been a guest on your show over the years, author of and the publisher, former publisher of the New American Magazine. And, also Alex Newman, who co-authored.
Yeah, sure. With Sam Blumenfeld.
You need to come up, even if you come up for the day. I'll send you the schedule.
Yeah, I'd like to.
He's
going to
come in Sunday and leave Monday night.
Okay.
He's
going to
give a class on the Common Core subject.
Excellent.
So.
It may be hard to believe, but people just like you are already saving money. FeedThePig.org makes it easy. Their simple savings plan teaches you how to start saving without going overboard, so you don't need to mooch off your friends.
You gonna finish that grape?
You mean the one in my mouth?
You don't need to stop buying the necessities.
What you're smelling is a natural musk.
Ew.
You don't need to be a medical test subject.
How do you feel?
Mostly okay. Sometimes, though.
You don't need to get a second job as a stuntman.
We need a new stuntman! Let's break for lunch.
You just need an internet connection. Don't get left behind. Start your personal savings plan with the tips and tools on feedthepig.org. That way, you don't need to sell your soul to the devil.
$15 is the best I can do.
All right, deal.
Brought to you by the American Institute of CPAs and the Ad Council.
This is the news. This morning, we are saluting the 2.2 million women who have joined in the war effort. They now make up 37% of the workforce, changing their role forever.
The prestigious Harvard Medical School is breaking ground today, opening its doors to new female applicants.
Today, little girls all over the world look to the sky, where the first woman is now in space.
Military stereotypes are challenged today with the trailblazing promotion of a U.S. female officer to four-star general.